Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking the only story in the world at the moment. We're back on the COVID, the COVID-19 agenda. Martin, first of all, listeners don't have the benefit of seeing this. Why do you look like you're heading out onto the streets at some sort of protest or something? What?
This is my normal gear, Tony. Combat trousers, T-shirt. This is normal.
That is very much... I'm not going to identify the scarf, but needless to say, he would look like he's heading out there to with a fist up in the air and giving it socks. Quick reminder to listeners, we are completely listener-led. We are no ads, no sponsors, but we do need people to help us out. We genuinely do. It's a lot of work, but you know, there's thousands of you listening. We need a few of you to come on board. patreon.com/tortoiseshack.
This year more than ever, because this is going to be the year. This is definitely going to be the year.
Anyway, look, enough patting ourselves on the back. We are delighted to be joined on the line by a member of the Independent Scientific and Advocacy Group, ISAG, and Associate Professor in UCD, academic Julian Mercel. Julian, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having us.
You wrote a very interesting article about the making this lockdown, the last lockdown. Obviously, the group that you're a member of advocate for zero COVID. I think zero COVID gets a bad rap because zero COVID doesn't actually mean, in terms of, you know, it's about pursuit of eradication. Do you want to explain, first of all, to listeners what the group are, and then we'll talk a little bit about the article?
Yeah, so the group is about, I'd say, 12 to 15 very active members. Most people come from Irish universities and Northern Irish universities as well. Public health experts, epidemiologists, mathematicians, data analysts, scientists who are in the life sciences, for example, and people like me who are more working on strategy and stakeholders relationships to bring on board, you know, unions or political parties or groups like that. So that's what it was formed in June, and we're advocating for zero COVID. Again, we have to say it quickly sometimes. It doesn't mean zero everywhere. Even China doesn't have zero everywhere. So the better way to explain it is probably a more aggressive policy on COVID to drive cases down as much as possible. Your target is zero, but if we got to level one, we'd be pretty happy compared to level five max or whatever.
I think that's a really important point for listeners. It's pursuit of zero. That's what it is. It's about going after it. It's about actually going after the virus as opposed to reacting to the virus. That is, as you know, we've passed mitigation. We are now in full panic mode with this lockdown, and we need to reverse that trend. Is it fair to say, you know, that you've seen, hopefully, in my opinion, in the last few weeks, that people have actually been more welcoming of the idea of at least talking about zero COVID than they were a few months ago?
Yeah, people are more open to it now. People who were on the fence before, because there's such a drastic rise in cases. It's a bit annoying that people came to us a bit more because it got so bad, as opposed to because of our powerful arguments or whatever. We have, you've seen the Social Democrats this morning. Actually, Roisin Shortall had an op-ed in the Irish Times, which is essentially our position. People before profit had been on board for a while. I think what we see now is that even if you have a vaccine, which is great news, we still are in a situation of, do we close the schools in a few days, right? So you need something else than the vaccine, and that's what we're about. In a way, everybody wants zero COVID. Michal Martin wants zero COVID, but it's just that he only thinks about the vaccine and washing your hands, for example, and your masks. But we have more tools in the toolbox to reach that goal faster. That's what the difference is about.
Would it be fair to say that the business community are looking at COVID too short term, on quarter by quarter or month by month, and they should be looking at this more long term, in that we need a solution that's going to last beyond a month, beyond a quarter, and that business interest is actually better served by a full lockdown and a pursuit of zero COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the position you explained is exactly our position. Exactly. The business community, though, we have relationships with them, right? We meet with all the trade groups we hear on the news. We meet with them. And the thing that's always striking to us is how much closer they are to us in private than in public. So the pub owners are not stupid. Like, they know that closing and opening, like, six, seven times over a year is like the worst strategy you can possibly imagine, right? But at the beginning, like the first 6 months or 8 months or whatever of the pandemic, they thought, okay, let's see what the government is doing. You know, in the summer, we had the best summer in Europe. Maybe that's it. Maybe the government got away with it because of luck or because they're actually good or whatever. So there's no point opposing the government right away. Now, you know, it seems that if you're a wet pub owner, you're going to be closed for the next 6 months, 1 year or whatever. So I asked them all the same question. Explain to me in business terms why it's better to close for 9 months as opposed to a month and a half right now and open for Paddy's Day. And when you ask that question, they understand, but it's just that for them, the big problem, which is the key issue for people to understand, is that they're willing to go along with a hard lockdown right now and open with normality. But if they don't have the trust that the government is getting its act together and has a good exit strategy, why would they do that? They will just say, well, okay, well, just open now. People will get sick, but otherwise I go bankrupt. So if you don't give me anything after the lockdown, I might as well push to open. And that's what we see on the news all the time. You know, every primetime show, they have a pub owner who's pissed off because they can't open or something.
Yeah, but that's the point that we've had in this country and across much of the West for years, where people say, oh, well, I'd pay more taxes if I thought I'd get something for it. You know, and they don't have a plan. They don't use it effectively. But you have a plan. You have a roadmap that you think, you know, how we could go and go pursue the virus as opposed to be reacting to it. Do you want to just give us a few of the points that you were suggesting of how you use that lockdown, how effective it can be?
Yeah, the first thing that's important about the plan is that it's completely plagiarized, right? There's nothing original about that plan. And it's completely plagiarized from Australia, New Zealand, China, Vietnam, all the countries that have been very successful. So it's not as if we have this idea that, you know, like a utopian endpoint that we firmly believe will work. It's proven to work. So all you have to do is to adapt it to Irish conditions, right? So the plan is, well, first of all, there's 8 points, right, in the article I wrote. So one is the vaccine roll out, and just to make sure that's going well as fast as possible. There's other things. When the cases are really, really high, like at the moment, you need a lockdown of some type. You know, you can debate, should we close the schools? Should we close this industry? Who is essential worker? Who is not? But in general, you need to lock down so that people don't mingle together too much. So is that, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 10 weeks? It depends on where you are. Maybe Galway was very, very close to zero cases in early December. People usually don't know that because nobody talks about it. But it wasn't the case in Dublin, for example. So you have variation over the geography of the country. So lockdown. A third point is financial economic supports, because you can't ask people to stay home and not work if you don't support them. So you do that. Other aspects are travel, quarantine. So there is no point locking down the country if you allow people who are infected to come in the country. That's what happened this summer. So this summer, we were all very proud of ourselves. And then one by one, travelers came back, either Irish or international. And about 60% of our infections now are related to the Spanish strain. So that means that You don't need a million people to come in to infect you. You just need a few dozens and they spread in the community and then eventually it's too big to handle. So if you don't regulate travel, we might as well just pack our bags and wait until the vaccine is rolled out, right?
Can I throw a spanner at you in this? Because it will be thrown at zero COVID, the north of Ireland. And that's the spanner that seems to be thrown at this all the time. But in reality, the north of Ireland is a very small population. You can be pretty much guaranteed that some of them will go along with the zero COVID plan. But again, it's not about getting to zero. It's about aiming for zero and stamping down on outbreaks and having everything in place, your contact tracing, everything you need in place to literally wipe it out when it shows its head. Isn't that the case, though?
Yeah, I mean, the Northern Ireland situation and the border, that's the Irish difficult part. Every country has their difficult conditions. That's it for us. So I talked quite a few times with people in Australia, like the Tony Holohan of Australia, or people like that.
And they had internal borders similar within states.
Exactly. That's why they're so relevant to us. And when you talk to the Australians, I'll give you an anecdote, and it illustrates so much about what we face here. I tried to contact the Garda here for like, I don't know, a week or something, asking them about what would be your plan for the border, those types of questions. I got nothing out of them. They're just across the road in Dublin. Only they would send me press releases that I could get online. It led nowhere. I called on a Sunday morning for Australia and on a Sunday night for Australia. I called a generic number, right? Wanting to have a specialist to talk to me. Within 5 minutes, I had someone there who answered all of my 20 questions or so. And they know what they're doing because they've done it. And a plan for a border is a bit complex because you have geographical zones and it really varies on the type of travel you're talking about. So people going from zone 3 to 2 or 2 to 3 or 2 to 1, you wonder how to manage that. And they knew it all. And the thing that's very interesting is that every time I would ask them something about Ireland, I was wondering maybe they'll say, well, I don't know, it doesn't apply to Australia, but it did. I mean, they faced the same, you know, construction workers cross border, for example. They had the answer right away. Oh, yeah, we did this, this and that. This didn't work, but that worked. Everything you ask, they know. So when I talk to them, what they say, first of all, is they say, look, the Northern Irish situation is not as easy as two states in Australia. You have a lot of crossings in your roads. You have a lot of traffic. That's fine. You're not going to get a perfect situation here like maybe we did in Australia. But then the second question was, okay, but do you think it's worth doing? And they said, well, absolutely. You'll get a good payoff. It's just that you don't want to aim for perfection. If you reduce your cases to a level 1, let's say, but that's amazing. The schools can open and life can go on until the vaccines come on board. So the Northern Ireland border, I think it's very often used as a cop-out by the political class that, you know, like they can't do anything because of the border. Like the border seems to be like this kind of magical thing that solves nothing, really. But it is true. You have to acknowledge that it's not, you know, that easy. Imagine if you had like 2,000 crossings instead of 300 or 400 and people were very, very bad and no compliance and they would really go cross the border no matter what, you couldn't probably not do it. But now the fact is that in Ireland, it's not that. People are compliant more or less and there's many crossings, but not like, you know, 2,000. There's some crossings you can regulate. And our plan also has been vetted by very high level guards that, you know, they all say, look, it's not an easy task, but it's a political will question, right? So all that big preface is just to say that there is a problem, but it's feasible. So what you do is that you really deal county by county. So it doesn't matter if you're a border county or a non-border county. If you have a county, wherever it is, that has high infection levels, you don't want that county to infect other counties. So you have to regulate traffic outwards of that county. Conversely, if you have a county that is really low level, let's say zero COVID, the last thing you want is to have that county infected from outside. So you have to protect it in a way and regulate traffic inwards. So if you're in Cork, that means you do that in Cork. If you're on the border, you do that on the border. And yes, you'll have the element of the Northern Ireland traffic, but it's not really that relevant. You can have a system of what's called bubbles. That means that people who live on the border and cross the border every day for whatever, school or work, there's no real point, you know, blocking those people because it would be too logistically difficult. And so you just give them permits or any other method that would work locally. And you say, look, you just crossed the border. That's fine. We won't bother with that because, you know, it's too complicated. In Australia, that's what they did. So you could look at maps, very nice PDF maps online of Australian states. They have the border bubbles by zip code. Everybody in those living in those bubbles, they can do whatever they like within the bubble. They won't bother. The police won't bother. It's people from outside. So you want to reduce the spread. So if you could contain the spread, the big infections to the border counties, let's say, and save the rest of the country, that wouldn't be perfect, but it'd be much, much better than what we have today.
And just on the actual logistics of this, because we spoke to Paul O'Brien, who was backwards and forwards from China. You're probably aware of him. Yeah. And he was the last time we spoke to him, he was in a hotel that the Chinese state had put him into for 2 weeks. Yeah. And he was collected from the airport and he was put into this. That is the case in most of these countries that are doing it well. However, they all have a system that if you are traveling for business purposes, it's under the idea that you know that you're going to be arriving and you're going to be spending your time in quarantine. I saw the Irish rugby player Rob Kearney talking about being in a hotel at the moment in Australia. You know, this is not undoable. It can be done. Is there a willingness when you're talking to people to actually Ireland go to that sort of thing where we will actually look at that? Because, you know, it just seems to be that we never really tried.
Yeah, there's a big split between the political class and everybody else. If you look at the opinion polls, the level of support for restrictions or more restrictions is astonishing. I think it was at 80%+ for the last 2 months or something, specifically about the question of quarantine for overseas travel. I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was very high as well. So people are not stupid. I mean, why would you want to let a virus go in the community and, you know, infect everybody? So it's a lack of political will. And I think in Ireland, there's a big European element to that. I cannot possibly believe if Germany and France tomorrow morning said, we're going for elimination, we're going to sort this out, Ireland would fall in place within about half a second. You know, I just cannot believe they would say, oh, no. For us, it's the border is so difficult. No, they would just go ahead. So I think it's they don't want to be the first ones to do it or something like that.
I completely agree with you on that European angle. It very much seems that they are afraid to move until the rest of Europe has made a decision. And yet we are unique in that we are quite a small, lightly populated island. I mean, if Europe wanted an experiment in zero COVID, Ireland is where you would have to look to start it. I do feel that there's a big follow my leader going on here in Europe at the moment. And indeed, we are so behind the curve on being prepared for, in comparison, we'll say, to Germany, we're so behind the curve. It's going to take us a lot more to get to zero COVID than it is for Germany to get to zero COVID.
Yeah, Ireland is an island, right? So it has natural advantages that make it easier normally. And if Ireland got its act together, it would be the leader of Europe. Whoever would do that, Leo Varadkar, Micheál Martin, would be reelected for the next 200 years, right?
I agree completely with you.
And the phone would be ringing every minute. Like, it is ringing every minute in Australia. Everybody, people like me, nobody is like me, call Australia on Sunday morning and say, I want to know how you did it. So the problem is that at the moment, there's no pressure, not enough pressure on the political class to change. People might be very unhappy with what it is, but the establishment doesn't feel that there's the costs of doing nothing or doing what they're doing is big enough for them to change. If you could get on board the opposition parties, the unions or IPEC or whatever, then the government would say, okay, if we keep doing it like that, the costs are too high. We have to change. We have to reorientate our strategy. But this is, it may change and it may get to that stage. But right now, they assess that it's not too damaging.
You make one crucial point in that. And I agree with you in so much of what you've said there. But I also think one point that we need to stress here is that the idea of IBEC, and we keep hearing about the Vintners Association, we hear about, you know, these other industries, we hear about lobbyists a lot in Ireland. Like we hear about the how they move between the corridors of power and the influence they have, and it's quite obvious to everybody who looks at it. But this is the most idiotic thing, because it's, Martin has referred to it on this podcast several times, trying to do COVID on the cheap. But it's going to be the most expensive way of doing it ultimately, because your business will be, instead of being out of operation, as you say, for, let's just say it was 8 weeks, let's say it was 12 weeks, you could be out, and you know, and that was what, and we had that as opposed to out for 6 weeks and then out for 6 weeks again and then out for 6 weeks again and rolling lockdowns. And, you know, I see today that they're talking about 25 to 35,000 vaccines a week, that then need to be rolled out to all of these people over two doses. I mean, this is a long time to be doing this. And the idea that your business, you're actually briefing against your own interests. Am I wrong when I think that?
That's how I see it. I asked in Australia again to the guys who made it happen, and I said, how did the business community react? And they said, oh my God, they were so myopic. It was unbelievable. Short term. And that's understandable. But it's one of the big question marks I've had. I mean, I understand that why they're doing it. It's basically for the reason I said previously, that they do not feel the government can carry out the strategy. So in this case, it's better for them to open now at 60% capacity or whatever, but at least you know, like we did for Christmas, for example. If they were convinced that the government would carry out the strategy and in 2 months everything would be more or less normal, I think then they would really get behind us.
They'd look at the options. But
yeah, and many of them are close to that. The best discussions we've had, it's all a bit confidential, but those trade groups, we've met them all, and they would agree with what you said, right? Most of them, if you look at their official public statements, some paragraphs, you would think ISAG wrote the paragraph, really, and it's not the case. You know, they say, can't we do like Australia and get our act together, not focus everything on washing hands? I think that's ISME, the small businesses. Like I said, it's a lot of first mover, you know, can I be the first one to do it? And but also look at the support.
We do have great advantages over other countries in that people are generally compliant. If you said we're going to be closed for 12 weeks or we will be closed until we reach X number, well, then people will work towards that and they will comply and we will get there. The problem is that the lobbyists get into the politicians' ears and what looked like a 12-week lockdown turns into a 3-week lockdown with limited opening. And then we're right back again. I'm finding it hard to see how we get past the short-termism, particularly when you have politicians playing up the vaccine, even though they know it'll be this time next year, if we're lucky, before enough people are vaccinated. So you're looking at a 12-month at least cycle where, I mean, there's another three lockdowns in 12 months.
And the very, very frustrating thing with Ireland is that we were this summer at about 3 weeks from being a New Zealand. 3 weeks. And in the group, see, I understand that rationally, but not by experience because I'm not an epidemiologist. The epidemiologists in our group are like, they cannot believe it. They said, my God, we were so close. We had it all. And then Varadkar wanted to give us our summer back
something. He made a speech where he quoted some summer night we'll meet again, and he accelerated the phases. He skipped, and that was the other thing that people need to understand. And I keep going back to it. We haven't stuck to one plan. not one plan. We've had several plans, and then they've gone, well, this one has five phases. We'll skip phase three and four. We'll just ramp through. This one has five levels, but there's not really five levels. It's kind of four plus two plus minus this, and we haven't had that plan. And I can understand why many in the business community have a lack of faith in the system to deliver, especially when you look at systems like, as you said, Track and Trace was working, and they ramped it down because they thought we had this thing done. And I genuinely think that part of the problem with what we're suffering from now was the fact that they thought when numbers didn't peak in hospitals, because you remember, again, the tarnished Leo Varadkar at that time said, let's not look at numbers, let's look at hospital admissions. He called for that. He said, let's do it like Belgium. And within 10 days, Belgium was
overrun. Yeah.
Was overrun. And I don't think it's really frustrating, because we have to remember this is what happened. This is the reality. Like, in years to come, academics like yourself, Julian, will go, how did we get this so badly wrong?
The thing to remember is that the plan living with the virus is the dumbest plan you could ever imagine. It's the equivalent of, let's say there is a neighborhood or a city that has massive crime rates. It's everybody is, you know, getting killed. The police gets there and says, oh, don't worry, people, we have a plan. We're just going to live with criminality. I mean, it would be the dumbest thing ever, but that's what it is. We're going to live with the virus. They just gave up from the start, you know? It's not even trying to fight the virus in the wrong way. It's, we don't do anything, you know?
So. It's like swimming in lane with a great white shark and expecting it to stay in lane. You know, it's not going to stay in lane.
Julian, I suppose, if people want to find more information about you guys, best source, Twitter,
we're active on Twitter. We also have a website, ISAG, I don't remember, ISAG, COVID-19.org, ISAG, COVID-19.org. We have our plan there, and there's some plan for Northern Ireland as well. And we promise to put more plans or white papers or whatever you want to call them on that website, but mostly Twitter. And one thing we've been very good at, which is somewhat surprising for someone like you guys who are interested in activism, is that we've been very good with the media, the mainstream media. We have a lot of presence on the media, much more than I thought we would get. So you can watch TV as well.
That just shows you, though, that there is an appetite for something different than living with the virus. We don't want to do that. And people, I genuinely believe, we spoke to Kevin Cunningham, the statistician, and he was outlining that even though there's a hardcore, he puts it at somewhere around 30% of people who just kind of follow with what the government's instruction is, you know, this is their plan, sure, we couldn't have an alternative. That still leaves a huge majority of people who are saying, give us an alternative, give it to us.
Yeah, and it's also that those stats, I mean, okay, 30% who want to do what the government is saying, considering the media is so horrible on COVID, on their coverage, you'd reduce that to easily 5% if the media did their job. And for example, we had reports on primetime of life in Australia, life in New Zealand, did they manage the border in Australia? It's very complex. I mean, not that much, but you need to investigate. No discussion whatsoever in Irish media. They talk about turkeys for Christmas and, you know, like, what gift did you get with whoever celebrity? So the media has been very bad. All the successful cases, and there are more than we think, they haven't been discussed that much. We only hear about, oh, Britain is so bad and Trump is so bad. So Ireland is so good, isn't it? All the reference points are in Europe, which is comparing yourself to losers. You know, that's not really the way to get better. And it would not be difficult to have a report on life in Australia. There's so many Irish people there. It's not like if there's no links and that, you just won't see it.
We need a government which will reach for the stars rather than point at the sewer. You know, we really do.
Look, Julian, Marcel, we're going to leave it there. Folks, do check out. It is ISAG, COVID-19.org. Do have a look. They're on Twitter. They're very active. But also, actually, if you're in discourse with your representatives, I know many of you are, tell them that we want to look at the alternative. Because the simple fact is, this is not going to go away just because we have a few thousand people getting the vaccine. These things. And more importantly, let's be ready, you know, as someone, as actually Anthony Staines, who's a member of the ISAG, has told us on this, you know, COVID might be actually a warning. We don't want, if the next one comes along and it's worse, we don't want to be in this position ever again. So let's take the learnings and let's do it properly.
Just want to remind everybody, we keep putting these pods out. It costs us time. It costs us money. Hand in pocket. Let's keep this going. And let's actually aim for zero COVID.
Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin. Martin and Tony. Speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.